Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking a college cost-cutting roadmap with Ron Lieber.
Yeah, Ron Lieber has been the Your Money columnist for the New York Times since 2008 and is a three-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award, which is financial and business journalism's highest honor. He is the author of multiple books, including the recently released The Price You Pay for College, which is already a definitive guide to help parents and students think through important decisions when it comes to higher education. He lives in Brooklyn with his wife, who is also a New York Times journalist, and his two daughters. And Ron, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Oh, it's so exciting to finally make my debut here.
We've been waiting for this, Ron, and you know the publication of this book was the perfect time to bring you on for sure. And the first question that we ask anybody who comes on the show, though, Matt and I, we like craft beer. That's one of the things we splurge on in the here and now while we're saving and investing for the future. But we want to know, like, what's your splurge? What's your craft beer equivalent?
Yeah, so beer hurts my belly, turns out. Yeah,
I'm
in
sorry.
My advancing age, it's not really agreeing with me, which is sort of unfortunate because I used to agree with it. So, in general, and this is a non-pandemic splurge, in general, I tend to splurge on live music experiences. Mm. To the extent that it's possible, I do not really spare much expense or think much about what it costs. And while I don't generally enjoy the process of embracing the, you know, sort of ticket scalping economy.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, Ticketmaster's the worst, right?
Ticketmaster, you know, on its own is a deeply problematic institution. the markups on StubHub or whatever, you know, I would so much rather the artists get those extra dollars.
Totally.
But in any event, right?
Do you remember the last show you went to see before everything shut down?
The last show I went to see versus the last splurge that was required. You know, I think there was a Hold Steady show somewhere in there close to the end. I'm a huge fan of the Hold Steady. Those tend not to be splurge tickets. You know, I will splurge on Broadway. I will splurge on Springsteen. Those are generally the big splurges.
Nice. Yeah, Ron's there at like the three nights in a row kind of show. He's like third row every night.
I mean, back in the day when touring was possible, I would go to, you know, three Dead shows, five Dead shows, two Fish shows, right? You know, I'm definitely a repeat customer for any rock and roll or related organization that does not repeat the set list from night to night.
Yes. Nice. Yeah, I love that. That's so good. Well, Ron, let's dive into your book, you know. We wanted to ask you, like, what led you to write this book in the first place? You know, like, you've written about money, but then specifically, you know, the price of college and student loans for years now. But, you know, we were wondering if part of the, you know, the impetus was having daughters and trying to figure this stuff out for yourself. Is that the case?
Yeah, I'd say some of that's true. I mean, the arc begins with the personal, but it sort of ends with the professional, right? So I have my first kid in 2005. I've got two daughters now. One of them is 15, a high school freshman. The other one is 5 and just started kindergarten. So, you know, the ninth grader is kind of creeping up on this stuff. So when she was born in 2005, I was at the Wall Street Journal and began, naturally, as one does, to write a little bit more about how to save for college. 529 plans, and they weren't so good at the time. There was a lot of mediocrity there. And so I spilled a little ink on that. 2008, 2009, I've moved over to the New York Times. During that recession, a lot of people washed out of some pretty expensive undergraduate institutions with 6 figures of undergraduate student loan debt that they had not needed a cosigner for. Things have changed a lot on the mechanics of how that happens or doesn't happen at this point, right? But there were a whole bunch of us who all of a sudden got radicalized around the, you know, sort of ever-growing nationwide student loan balance. And for at least 10 years now, I've written about student loans off and on, you know, to this day. But what happened in 2015 that really had nothing to do with me and everything to do do with readers, is that my email inbox and my voicemail started to fill up an ever higher volume each spring with parents who were having three related problems. There were the parents who had just assumed they were going to get a bunch of financial aid for their kid and did not realize until the very end that they were not going to be eligible. And they had made a bunch of promises to their kids that they weren't sure they were going to be able to keep anymore. So that was a problem. Second kind of parent, they had been offered with their first or their only kid this thing known as merit aid in the financial aid award letter. And they hadn't even realized they'd applied for this, didn't know what it was. College counselor hadn't explained it to them. And so they come to me and they're like, Ron, what's this merit aid stuff? And can I get some more of it? Right? And, you know, it's April 12th. I can't really do much for them at that point. So that troubled me. But what really put me over the edge was that I started to get calls from slightly more sophisticated parents, right? Parents who had figured out the system. They had, you know, sort of understood it and known to do the research, but they were having a different set of challenges. You know, imagine a New York State resident. The kid gets into Binghamton, which is, you know, arguably the best or the flagship state university. The kid gets into Kenyon College in Ohio or Occidental College in Los Angeles, and there they're not being asked to pay the full price. They get a merit aid package, and so the school's going to cost them $200,000 over 4 years. And then the kid manages to get into Cornell. You know, it's got an Ivy League invitation, but no discount there. That family earns, let's call it, $257,000 a year. Cry them a river, right? But they don't qualify for any need-based aid. So they said to me, Ron, your newspaper hasn't shut up about the fact that we live in the era of big data, right? So where is the big data set that tells me how and why Cornell is $100,000 better than Kenyon and $200,000 better than Binghamton? And I had no idea, because the big data set doesn't exist. There isn't even a small data set on this stuff. And what I realized was that these readers were asking questions about value and values ultimately, because values are, you know, part and parcel of how we make the value decision. And so for all the ink that I had spilled over how to save and how to pay, I had not gotten it through my thick skull in the space of 10 years, right? That the most important question of all was what to pay for college. That's what these people were trying to figure out. And I had failed them to that point. And I realized that there was going to be no way to answer that question in a newspaper column or in 5 or in 10. And it was going to require a book.
Yeah, something more like 320 pages, right?
Pretty much.
Hey, Ron, we've all seen the chart that shows how the cost of college has been soaring over the past 40 years, you know, talking about value, and everyone has been bending over backwards to try to explain why. But in your book, you actually discuss how that stat is a little misleading. The college costs haven't been rising at maybe the clip that we thought they've been rising at. Can you kind of explain that?
Sure. So, you know, it gets complicated for many of my customers, right? I mean, they're readers, but I also think of them as customers because they pay to subscribe to the New York Times and they pay, you know, $27 at the list price for a hardcover nonfiction book. The demographics of those folks, you know, tend to be upper middle class. And the farther you get into the upper middle class, the less likely it is that you are going to be offered any need-based financial aid. So many of those folks are anchored to the list price of schools because they think that's what they're going to pay. Now, that's quite often not the case, but right, that's sort of what people anchor to, at least in my customer base. So they're thinking, okay, you know, 50 most selective schools in America, I want the best for my kid. That's going to be $300,000. Right at the private level. And, you know, my flagship state university probably going to cost $100,000 by the time it's all over with. What they do not realize is that the average discount at private colleges is over 50%. And moreover, 90% or so of families are not paying the full price. Wow. And that includes a whole bunch of rich kids who are getting discounts anyway. Mm. Right. So when you say that to people, they're like, huh? How did that happen? And then you've got to spend like a minimum of 10 minutes slowly and deliberately peeling back the layers of the onion.
I mean, essentially, it's kind of like the difference between the sticker price and the actual cost that they pay. You know, so like what's going on with this? You know, essentially, it's like a charade, you know? Why don't colleges just like lower the actual tuition costs, you know, and the price, you know, the cost of education in a more straightforward manner? Like, why is it that we have these, you know, this inflation kind of built into the price of
the sticker price and the massive discount?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you sort of have to think about it like a business person, which we're not used to, you know, thinking of when we think of colleges, because we don't think of them as the viciously competitive institutions that they actually are, right? There's a real competition to get the heads in the beds and to make sure you've got, you know, the right net tuition revenue per student to make your numbers and to make your budget. So here's what's going on there. First of all, there is a perceived value question. That's kind of at the root of some of this. It's referred to in the industry as the Chivas-Regal effect. And it goes like this, and this is a legend, right? I was not able to confirm it with Chivas because they won't talk to me about it. But the way, strangely, right?
Like, why? Any legend that has to do with a liquor, I'm down for it. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess they did not want to pierce the bubble of, you know, whatever it was that they thought was over and around their brand. But as the legend goes, one day, many years ago, in a galaxy far, far away, someone at Chivas Regal decided to, you know, double the price overnight to try and increase the brand sort of perceived value on the liquor store shelf. And sure enough, the company's revenues, you know, increased by like way more than they expected it to, because all of a sudden people thought that Chivas Regal was better than it used to be, even though nothing changed inside the bottle, right? And so the lesson that higher education professionals took from this is that if you have a high list price, people will think that you are worth something, worth more, right? And then when you give them a discount, particularly when they don't need the discount, right? Particularly if they can afford to pay the full price, that family will feel like they've gotten a bonus, maybe a gold star, a pat on the head for having raised
feels
a meritorious kid. Yeah.
Who doesn't want to get a
really
deal?
Good, right? You know, this is marketing. This is marketing. And the other thing is, at any given institution, particularly the more selective ones that still discount this way, they are always holding out hope that some percentage of people will turn up each year who are, in fact, both willing and able to pay the full price, and not just able, right? And so what kind of family is that? Well, if you are a super affluent family and you have no idea that these discounts exist, and you don't really care all that much about money, and you're not careful, you'll just write the check, right? And you'll never be the wiser, right? So schools like to take advantage of families like that. Then there are the families who are like writing this check against the bank of thank God, right? So, you know, imagine yourself, you know, just hoping against hope that your kid will go to Tulane University the same way that you did, right? And you know that the place is much more selective than it used to be. And maybe your kid has had a rough go of it, you know, freshman, sophomore year in high school, but they've like totally turned it around junior year. They managed to get, you know, a seat at an SAT test center. And wouldn't you know it, they scored a 1520. And Tulane says, you know what? We're going to take a shot on your kid. We're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. We believe in your family and, you know, and its tradition of coming to school here, but no discount for you. And you're like, wow, I can't believe we pulled this off. The kid's going to go to Tulane. We don't care what it costs, right?
Right.
Bank of thank God. And then there are all of these families from outside the United States. And, you know, many of them are gazillionaires and they don't care much about the price either. They just want a degree from a relatively brand name institution, or, you know, just one that says America on it. And if you can attract enough of those folks, particularly now that there is someone in the White House who is not as high hostile to people showing up here from outside of the United States in general, you have reason to hope, right? So those are all the reasons you keep the list price high.
Ron, let's talk about college enrollment and COVID. Obviously, we've seen college enrollment fall because of the pandemic. And you actually mentioned a study in your book that 60% of professors and administrators have said that their courses are worse in the virtual era. So how do you think that college, the college value proposition has changed because of COVID?
Well, so, you know, we should stop and think about how we define decline, right? Because in different tiers of undergraduate education, there have been different levels of decline. And at the, you know, let's call it 200 most selective colleges and institutions in America, the ones that have stayed open more or less, have not seen huge declines, sort of devastating revenue declines. And the thing that's interesting about it is that, people are showing up to pay the same prices they paid last year for the most part. You know, there've been a few discounts here and there, but not many, right? And so I guess here's what I have to say about that, right? What happened in the spring of 2020 is that everybody got sent home, and all of a sudden, the three main reasons for going to college, right? The education, the kinship, the friends you make and the mentors you acquire, and the credential. Two of those things were stripped away, as you mentioned in the question, right? Education got a lot worse. Everybody acknowledges that. Kinship is like blown to smithereens because mm-hmm. you're not near your friends or your mentors anymore. Only the credential is left. And, it's of some question, how much the credential matters, right? If you are a food and beverage major at Cornell University, right, you're majoring in hotel management, at Arizona State or something, like how much is that credential going to be worth right now when those industries have been cut to ribbons? So, the value is not what it once was, which it makes it somewhat surprising, right, that all of these people came running back to campus in August and September of 2020 against all, sort of public health reason. And, thousands and thousands and thousands of them got sick, right? So why did they do this? Well, because the education had gotten worse, because the kinship was gone, and, people were desperate to continue to persist with this experience. Now, if I'm writing a check up to $80,000 a year, I ain't doing it. It doesn't make any sense to me, right? This is not a normal college experience. This is not what I signed up for my kids. And as somebody who wrote a book about gap years back in 1996, I already think the college is wasted on most 18-year-olds. So, my kid is sitting this one out and going to do something different for a while.
Ron, this has been a great start to our conversation. We've got so much more we want to talk about with you. We want to talk next about financial aid, like how it is that parents and students can get that 50% discount like you mentioned there earlier. And we're going to get to all of that right after the break.
All right, we're back. We're talking with Ron Lieber about how to get a better deal when you're going to college. And, Ron, one of the things actually that recently changed it surrounded financial aid was the expected family contribution when you fill out the FAFSA. Sadly, that happened after the publication of your book, but you wrote about it in the New York Times since then. So what effect is that change in the FAFSA going to have on families?
Sure. So let's start by, framing what we're talking about here. We are talking about the need-based financial aid system. The FAFSA does not have much of anything to do with merit aid, whole different way that merit aid and those discounts are awarded, right? So what we're talking about here is need-based aid. In order to get aid from the federal government, so in order to, access a Pell Grant or the Federal Student Loan Program or federal work study funds for jobs on campus or Parent Plus loan, you got to fill out one of these FAFSA things. And people hate the FAFSA. The FAFSA is arguably more complicated than the 1040, income tax form. And, the kid gets involved and the parents are involved and some parents refuse to do it. And if you're a kid who's estranged from your parents or a parent, it gets very complicated, super, super messy stuff. So, the most important thing that's happened is that the FAFSA is going to be simplified, which is a good thing, right? It's going to be easier to fill this thing out. A couple other things are happening. It's going to be easier for more people to get Pell Grants, and the Pell Grants are going to get a little bit larger, right? So people with lower incomes going to have an easier time. Now, there's some other things that are changing that have caused, people in the, middle class and upper middle class to wring their hands. One of the provisions has to do with the fact that if you've got two kids in college at once, you're no longer going to get the same break that you used to. Now, that's according to, the legislation and the federal law. Doesn't mean that private colleges are necessarily going to do the same thing with their financial aid formulas. So if you're thinking about applying to a school that only relies on the FAFSA, you know, then you may need to be thinking about that if you've got two kids and they're close in age. So much remains to be seen on, you know, sort of exactly how that's going to be interpreted. And there are a lot of people already trying to petition, you know, the federal government to change that somehow, right? Whether through legislation or some other form. So, you know, remains to be seen, I think, exactly how that one's going to play out. But it's definitely one to watch. It doesn't go into effect for another year and a half.
Yeah, it's certainly a work in progress. It's kind of a moving target, I guess, as you have kids, you know, approaching college age. And so, yeah, you're talking about need-based aid here. And then earlier, you know, you detailed how the financial aid system has changed in recent years. And, you know, let's talk about merit aid. So, you know, that is kind of it seems that that's the predominant form of financial assistance these days. And so what is it that led to that change? And how can parents and students navigate getting more merit aid money?
Sure. So, you know, I like that you phrased that question by pointing at the history, because it gives an opportunity to sort of tell the story of not how it started exactly, but how it spread and became so complicated. So imagine yourself in the state of Ohio in the early 90s, and there's a whole bunch of really good, you know, small liberal arts colleges. So many, in fact, that they're really, you know, beating the smithereens out of one another, you know, to in the competition for students, and also a great public university system there, right? So imagine being, you know, kind of near the bottom of that food chain. You know, imagine being Ohio Wesleyan University. You've developed a well-earned reputation for, you know, being a serious party school that is not particularly serious about other things. You want to increase your prestige because a lot of families just won't go near you because, you know, they think their kids will end up being alcoholics, right? So you've got to do something about this situation. So what you do is, you know, after this year's crop of kids take the PSATs, you start going out and you buy the names of the kids who have better PSAT scores than the kids you normally attract into your applicant pool. And you send them a note saying, hey, we've got our eye on you. We know you're special. If you apply here, and we'll let you apply here for free with no application fee, if you apply over here, we'll give you $10,000 if you come. Off the list price, right? No matter how much money your family has, no matter how much money your family needs, right? So somebody starts going and throwing around five figures of money when nobody else is doing that, that's going to have an impact, right? It worked. It worked so well that competitors had to respond in kind, because Denison did not like Ohio Wesleyan stealing more than its fair share of students. And Kenyon didn't like Denison stealing kids. And, you know, Kenyon didn't like College of Worcester doing the same thing either. And then Oberlin got really annoyed that Kenyon started to do it. And pretty soon everybody in the state of Ohio is doing this. And it spreads, not quickly, but over time. So, right, you flash forward 20 years or so, and all but the 50 or 60 most selective colleges and universities, both public and private, although it works a little differently, public and private, all but the 50 or 60 most selectives in the country are offering at least some merit aid, right? So you take that enormous list of schools that are doing this, and those two divide up into segments, right? There are the schools that only offer merit aid to a couple of dozen people a year. Then there's schools that only offer it to a couple hundred of, you know, new entrants a year. Then it's, you know, schools that offer it to maybe half of the new people who come in each year. And then there are schools now where everybody gets a pony, right? Where everybody gets a pat on the head. And the challenge for families is to figure out ahead of time which kind of school you're dealing with, what sort of reasonable expectation they ought to have, you know, for a discount offer, and how to sort that out. And it is not easy. It's another 5 or 10 minutes of, you know, verbiage to kind of even begin to explain to people how to sort it out.
All right. So, well, it does kind of beg the question, how can people find out what sort of merit aid they're likely to receive from a college they're interested in? I don't want to, you know, make you drone on for 10 minutes necessarily, but that is the question that people are going to ask. Like, if I'm interested in a particular college, how do I know what sort of, you know, aid to expect?
Yeah. So there are a couple things that people should know. First of all, the net price calculator, which all schools are required to have on their website somewhere, is a way to predict what kind, if any, of need-based financial aid you will be offered. So totally worth filling those out. In some instances, the schools will allow you to input your GPA and your test scores, and will attempt to predict what kind of merit aid offer you might get as well. So it's worth checking the net price calculator to see if it is in fact a merit aid prediction engine. In most instances it is not, but sometimes it is, so you know, worth a shot. So that's number one. Number two, by all means, check the college's website to see if they say, you know, what percentage of people got merit aid last year, what sort of characteristics did they have. At some of the more hard up schools, Wabash College in Indiana, Lake Forest in Illinois, the University of Alabama does this as well. They just tell you straight up in like a grid chart, you know, if you've got a 34 on your ACT and a 3.9 GPA, you know, this is how much of a discount you'll be offered. And so that causes a lot of people who really want to, you know, go to the University of Alabama to take their SATs six times to, you know, to sort of try to get their score high enough to get the better deal. You know, so it has some unintended effects. Next step, and this is not the last step, because why should this be simple? Where am I after all? The next step involves looking for something called the common data set, which most but not all schools make available. The common data set contains all of the information that these schools pass on to ranking organizations like US News and World Report. It's worth reading the entire common data set if you are even at all interested in any institution, no matter how much you are able or willing to pay, because there's all sorts of terrific data in there. But in section H2A of
my favorite section, dataset. Personally.
Yes, yes, yeah, right? It's like you just like go right to H2A, and that'll give you some information about how much merit aid is being offered to families who have no financial need whatsoever. So that's a pretty good indicator of what's going on. You know, is the school offering merit aid to everybody who has no need, or just like, you know, 10% of the people who have no need? And what are the characteristics of the people in the class, in every entering class, who are in the top 25%? You know, what's their GPA? What's their test scores? That is information you can get from the common data set. And so from there, you can begin to sort of guess, right, what is going to happen. This is not the end. There's at least two more steps. Shall we keep going?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's cover them.
All right, two more steps. All right. Because this is so confusing, because I have had to prattle on for so long, not one, not two, not three, but four that I know of, for-profit entities have started up just in the last couple of years to try to provide some predictability or matchmaking around this. Tuitionfit.com.
That was the one that seemed the most, like the coolest idea from what I read in your book. Like, TuitionFit seems awesome.
Yeah. So the big idea is like you send in your, you know, award letter to TuitionFit. It anonymizes everything, puts it into a database. And then all of a sudden, you've got some context, right? So, you know, Denison University in Ohio offers you, you know, $21,000 off, and you've got a, you know, 32 on your ACT. You can go in there and see, oh, look, there's a student with statistics like mine, and she got $25,000 off. And I'm a boy, right? So should I be more valuable because Denison's like 59% female? Or like, what's going on here, right? You know, the fact that I play an oboe and maybe she doesn't, like, is that going to matter? It could matter, right? You know,
it could matter,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, it gives you a little bit of anecdotal context. You know, it's not like scientifically
sufficient.
Yeah,
it's not scientific, but you get to hear from people. It's sort of like Glassdoor, but for colleges, right?
Yeah. That's a really good comparison. Yeah,
yeah.
It's about like that. And then there's a company called Edmit, EDMIT. There's a new one called Merit More. And Debbie Schwartz, who runs the Pain for College 101 Facebook group, which is indispensable to my mind for anybody who wants to geek out on this. She's got her own hustle there where she has some merit aid prediction figures that she generates using common data sets and other tools, right? So there's like four startups in the area. And then finally, right, I want all of my readers to act and behave as if we exist in the world that we want it to be and not the world as it is. So I'm encouraging everybody. I'm trying to raise an army, essentially. I think everybody should innocently, but not so innocently, call these schools each September and say, hey, I don't have any real way to predict what kind of merit aid my kid might be offered here, and you seem to think that I should be willing to apply without having any idea what the price is. And that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Does it make sense to you? No, I didn't think it made any sense. Can you give me a non-binding merit aid pre-read given my kids, activities and SATs and GPA? And if they won't do it, if they refuse to, then you might say, oh, that's so interesting, because College of Worcester has been doing that for years, and Whitman College just started doing it a year ago, and you don't want to do that. Huh. Why?
I love that tip, Ron, because it's taking things into your own hands and saying and kind of asking for the information when it's not readily available. I think that's like wonderful advice.
I mean, exactly. Tell them I sent you. and if they won't cough up the information, come and tell me at ronlieber.com.
You're going to start getting death threats, Ron.
And I'll call them up. I'll call them up.
I love that the fifth point here is the Ron Lieber way, which is calling for more transparency when it comes to merit aid and
barking
colleges.
Up the tree.
I love it. Yeah. Let's talk about real quickly here, like getting what you pay for. You know, you spend a lot of time in your book writing about value. We're all about getting, the most bang for your buck when it comes to higher education. So, like, what should students and parents be looking for in a college? And I know you cover a lot of this in your book, so
pages dedicated to it, but
if you wanted to pick like a few of your favorites here, I'm curious to hear your thoughts here.
Well, it starts with a framing question, right? You can't have that conversation before you have defined what college means to you. And this is not some like existential philosophy 101 exercise. It's actually a real non-rhetorical question, because what I found repeatedly as I ran laps of the country was that there were a whole bunch of people out there, flinging hundreds of thousands of dollars around that hadn't really stopped to ask themselves, like, what is the definition of success here and how much is enough? Right? What is college for anyway? And it turns out that college is for three things. We name checked them before, right? College is about the intellectual roller coaster ride. It's about the learning. It's about having your brain broken apart and then reassembled by an expert practitioner into like a bigger, better version of what it used to be, right? So college is about the education, number one. Number two, college is about the kinship. It's about finding the people you never could have imagined existing in the world and making them your best friends who will pick you up on their shoulders and carry you through life. And it's about finding the mentors who will do the same thing, but maybe they're like dragging you by the neck, into a bigger and better version of yourself, right? Uh-huh. So that's number two. Number three is the credential. Maybe it's a baseline credential that allows you to, grasp hold of the middle class in a way that your family has not been able to before. Or maybe you're reaching way up high for like the super name brand institution where the degree will mean something in an industry that your family or your community has absolutely no hope of ever accessing without that degree, right? So you got to know what you're coming for. And once you do, you can shop for that, right? Because if you could care less about learning anything, then it doesn't matter whether there are graduate students teaching all of the introductory level courses, because that's not what you're there for, right? Like, imagine yourself as the, third generation child of a casket-owning manufacturer in southern Indiana, right?
And you're going to go to the... Yeah.
Right?
So you're going to go to the... I'm picturing it right now.
Yeah, so you're going to go to the... Did you know that southern Indiana is like the world capital of casket manufacturing?
Oh, no, I didn't. I thought you were just pulling that out of thin air.
No, wait. Back when I was at Fast Company magazine in the 90s, I went to visit one of the casket companies. It was awesome.
Crazy.
You can put that story in the show notes if you want.
We'll look it up.
So you're going to the Kelley School of Business, flagship state school, Indiana University, undergraduate, and you really care about the learning because you're going to learn what you need to know on the job, right? From your parents, from your grandparents, right? They're going to teach you everything that you need to know. What you really want out of the Kelley School of Business is not the credential, because the credential doesn't mean much. You just want to build the best possible network, right? You want a whole bunch of people who are going to know you, remember you, and when they die or their parents die, they're going to get your casket. They're going to call you up. You're going to offer them the friends and family discount code, and your family casket company is going to be known because you are in the most social sorority. You are in the most business-oriented fraternity. You are at the Kelley School of Business for the kinship and the kinship alone, right? So that's a way to shop, and I totally approve of that. Do whatever you want, right? But don't go into the process without having asked the fundamental question and answered it about what college is for.
Love that. All right. Hey, Ron, we got a few more super practical questions about cutting college costs, and we'll get to those right after this break.
All right, we are back. We're talking with Ron Lieber in his most recent book, The Price You Pay for College. And, you know, Ron, before the break, we're talking about financial aid. And now we're going to kind of dive into some more practical advice to maybe potentially get the price down on college. And real quick, you know, you mentioned in the first section there the gap year. You said you mentioned you wrote a book back in 1996 about the gap year. Do you feel that that's a good idea? Is a gap year a good idea for folks to potentially save some money, to not burn, not waste that first year in college? And then specifically too, in like now with COVID, does it make even more sense, you know, due to the pandemic?
Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes.
And okay, good.
And if we're going to limit it just to, you know, kind of pushing the answer through a financial prism, like let me try and do it that way. So, you know, first the obvious, right? If you can stay in your house, if it's safe to do so, you know, psychologically and physically, and it's not for every kid and every family. If your parents or parent are willing to let you live there, hopefully rent free, maybe even continue to provide the food, right? You can go work for 12 months and make 20 grand and, you know, put it away. And that's 1/5 of the cost of college at, you know, most flagship state universities. That's a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. Go do that if you need the money. You can work for 9 months and, you know, save half the money and take the other half and go have an adventure someplace. These are things that you can do. And so, you know, it's worthwhile for all sorts of developmental reasons, which we'll leave aside for now. But if you believe in extracting the most value that you possibly can from the classroom in particular, people who take gap years get better grades than those who don't. This has now been proven with like real PhDs conducting science on the matter, right? So, you know, if you want to extract more value from the education, take a gap year, go to college when you're 19, not when you're 18. There still seems to be the possibility that, you know, the private colleges and universities in particular will give you a better deal on financial aid if they don't follow the, you know, the new federal formula, if you have overlap, right? So if you've got a sibling and you are 3 years older than your sibling, if you take a gap year, you're essentially adding one more year to the potential years of overlap where the two of you are in college if your sibling does not take a gap year. So you want to think about that too. You could literally, you know, create another 5 figures worth of need-based aid eligibility for some families if the privates continue to run their aid formulas the same way. So that's a lot of ifs, right?
So they're assuming that
but
maybe
we're thinking about it.
Your younger brother or sister might also go to the same school, and that's why they're going to offer you more money?
So just in general, the way the formula works now, and this is what the FAFSA proposes to change, but the, you know, private universities may not follow it, is that, you know, logic would dictate if you've got two kids in college at once, you can afford to pay less than if you only have one kid in college at once, right? So if you increase the number of years of overlap, that increases the number of years that you have those extra discounts, assuming both colleges are kind of operating with similar formulas.
Gotcha. Yeah, so Ron, community college, at least for a couple years of your college education, has always been a popular suggestion as a way for people to save money. But you actually say that going that route could cost you more than it saves. Why is that?
I am not trying to discourage people from going to community college. I am only trying to make sure that people are realistic about what actually happens, right? So the fact of the matter is that it's a pretty small percentage of people who start at community college with the intent of getting to a four-year school, you know, and graduating in a reasonable period of time. It's a small percentage of people who actually pull it off. So if you're doing this as a hack, right, as a way to save money, I'm all for it, but you need to go in with eyes wide open. And here's what that means, right? You've got to show up with a full head of steam, You've got to have an intended destination in mind, preferably a you know, major at that school. You've got to know at the very beginning what classes you're going to need at the community college. You need to be first in line to make sure you get those classes. If you're going to be working for money on the side, you need to have a job that, you know, allows you to put your classes, you know, priority one, right? So you get all your classes and you're constantly in touch with an advisor at the community college to make absolutely sure that these classes are going to transfer to your intended destination. You have a different advisor at the destination in the admissions office, checking in with you three times a term to make sure that nothing's changed, everything's on track, you're going to get your credit. And then if you know that you want to be a computer science major at the intended destination, you got to be certain that the chair of that comp sci department is absolutely positively going to approve your prerequisites. Because if you got to retake a bunch of stuff, then it takes longer, you're spending more money, and the savings is decreased. So, you know, it's not always simple.
That's so smart. Yeah. It kind of goes back to knowing your why. Like, as long as you can keep in mind what, like, why it is that you are going to the community college and you keep that forefront in your mind, then yeah, it can be a great hack, like you said. Right. Is there a good rule of thumb, like, for how many schools that families should visit or apply to in order to make sure that, you know, they're getting the best price possible?
Yeah, you know, I'm struggling with this some personally because my daughter's in ninth grade. I don't take much stock in this notion that you're going to do damage to your children by talking to them about college, you know, before their junior year, that it's like too much too soon, too much pressure. I mean, these kids live in the world. They already understand that, you know, college exists and they're thinking about it and excited about it. And so, you know, I might take our daughter to, you know, see her first school sort of informally in a couple weeks, actually, you know, in the second half of her first year in high school.
Start her young. I like it.
Yeah, right. Well, it's just, you know, it literally pays to tour these places carefully and not rush around on a tour and an information session and be in and out in 3 hours, right? And so that takes time, right? It takes money and it takes resources too if you're doing it in person. But it certainly takes time to like really do the homework on, you know, a couple of dozen places to begin to think like, huh, you know, big versus small, maybe I should go see some places, right? Urban versus rural, right? Single sex, non-single sex, right? Small liberal arts, you know, large, enormous university, right? So, you know, it can take a year or two to kind of narrow that down or begin to think about it. And then, right, particularly this year and last year too, this was the case, you know, there's a higher probability of like outsized surprises financially because all the algorithms that the schools normally use to, you know, offer up discounts and, you know, sort people out, they're having trouble predicting how people are going to behave in the middle of a global pandemic. No surprise there, right? And so schools that come up real short in March and April start to get worried. You know, they're going to throw a lot of money around and they just might throw it at you. And so, you know, the more schools you've applied to, the better chance you have of having some kind of awesome financial surprise.
Nice. And we got one more question for you, Ron. You talk about independent college counselors towards the end of the book. When does it make sense for a family to hire someone to help them make these big decisions? Because obviously your book is like 320 pages long. And it feels like one of these things for a lot of families that's overwhelming. So yeah, should they be hiring someone who's in their corner who knows more than they do?
I'm a big believer in paying for professional services when the stakes are high, and the stakes are high here. The thing that I have not solved for that pained me greatly in the writing of The Price You Pay for College is that it still doesn't feel to me like there is a fail-safe way to go looking for an independent college counselor and know for sure just how smart they are on need-based aid and merit aid. Because let's face it, right? You know, if you're going to hang a shingle as an independent college counselor, what you want to do is, you know, charge as much money as you possibly can. But the people who need financial aid or the people who, you know, feel like they need merit aid, they can't afford to pay you a $10,000 retainer, right? And so it doesn't make a lot of financial sense for an independent counselor to focus much on that part of the market. And so the question then becomes, well, how do I find the practitioner who is an expert on a family like mine that earns $172,000 a year is going to have, you know, some financial need, maybe at private universities, but probably not a ton, but is super interested in merit aid. Like, where is my expert that really understands that part of the market? And, you know, the answer to that question is there aren't actually all that many of them. I wish there were more.
It's almost like there needs to be a tuition fit for advisors. Like, right. Like, you know, like, I mean, if there's some sort of database or something like that where folks could kind of give their feedback on, you know, with their profiles as to how much money that they were able to retain.
Yes, exactly. Right. And so there are four or five associations of independent college counselors, and one of them has a subgroup of people who are real interested in this stuff. But I can't even get that association to make the names of those members public anywhere on their, you know, consumer search page. I tried, right? You would think that like that would be a resource worth making available and shining a light on, but it hasn't worked yet, to my great frustration.
Mm-hmm. Well,
anyway, if people want to email me, you know, I know a handful of people who I know are good, and I don't mind throwing some names out. So, you know, I'm at ronlieber.com. I'm easy to find.
Ron, you're the best. And obviously people can find you at ronlieber.com. They can find you in the New York Times, you know, on a weekly basis, and they can find your new book, The Price You Pay for College. Anything else you want to tell folks, tell our listeners about you?
No, just that I'm, you know, glad to have this out there. I am here to help. And my feeling about this after it was all said and done was hope more than anything else. You know, I went to a lot of schools, and nice. I could imagine my daughter happy and thriving at just about all of them.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that even through all of this, yeah, you were able to land on hope at the end of it. So, Ron, you rock. Thank you so much for this this conversation. And we appreciate it, man.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
All right, Matt. Ron Lieber just rocketed up the list of my favorite human beings.
Yeah.
What a fun conversation and just enlightening. He brought so much passion, wisdom, and energy to this conversation.
Yeah. I honestly wish our oldest kids, my oldest daughter was even older almost, so I could put some of this to work.
Immediately.
Some of what I learned, I want to implement. And I think sometimes when you sit on knowledge like this, it's just like, well, this is good to know now, but I wish I could put this to use. You know, I want to start saving myself money now.
Makes me want to adopt a 14-year-old.
Do it, dude.
So I can implement it.
Do
it. That would, you know, throw off some other family dynamics. But
yeah. Talk to your wife about that first.
Yeah, before I just pull the trigger on that one. What was your big takeaway from our convo with Ron?
Well, I liked at the end, we asked about community college, and he specifically, you know, made a point to say that he wasn't against community college in order to save money, but how a high percentage of folks who go to community college don't actually end up transferring to a state or private school. And he said that if that is your approach, if that's what you're going to do, you're going to go to your local community college to save some money, get some of the prerequisites, some of the base classes out of the way, you need to make sure that you have in mind your goal, your end goal. You need to know your why. And specifically, he said how it's good to have a specific school in mind. You know, like, you're not just going to community college to save money so that you don't have to pay that money to where? To what school? You know, like, have a school in mind, even have a specific degree in mind.
There's nothing worse than not having credits transfer when you're like, oh, this is totally going to work out.
Then you're paying twice.
Yeah.
And
you're doing twice the work, not just twice the money. But
oh, my gosh. And he recommended to specifically be in touch with an advisor at that target school. Be in touch with them.
Smart.
Check in with them multiple times every semester. Make sure that the classes you're taking, make sure that the classes you're signing up for next semester, that those are all going to apply to whatever degree that you're looking to pursue at that specific school. It's going to give you so much clarity. And you're on a path. You're on a track versus just kind of going to community college and feeling like, all right, I'm going to land somewhere. I'm not totally sure where, but that has a ton of negative consequences down the road because things may not line up. Those credits may not count.
Yeah. Well, I think my big takeaway from our conversation here,
let me hear it,
was that the average discount at a private school is 50%.
Like, so big.
That's huge, right? And so I think the biggest thing, the way that translates for our listeners out there is if your kid is excited to go to a school, don't necessarily let that sticker price make you think that you can't afford it, because that sticker price doesn't reflect what most people pay to go to that university. And I think sometimes people can be like, man, that school's really expensive. And it is. But at the same time, there are all sorts of merit aid opportunities for you to go to that school at a greatly reduced price.
Yeah, not only merit aid, but the need-based aid as well. But like, I think it's important just to be aware of the fact that there's a game that you're playing. Yeah. You know, it's sort of like, I mean, we don't recommend for folks, like everyone, to go out there and buy a new car. Like for some folks, it makes sense, not for everybody. But if you go to a dealership, you have to know that you're playing a game, you know, like there's a process, there's a dance.
And there's a way to win. And then there's like an uninformed way to lose.
Yeah, exactly. And we do not want folks to be uninformed and losing when it comes to, you know, what they're spending on their kids' college or what students are out there, what loans they're taking out in order to go to that school. It's so important. And I'm glad that we were able to talk about that today with Ron. I'm also glad that you and I, we got to share a different type of beer. This isn't a style that we normally have on the show, but I'm glad we were able to switch it up, man.
Yeah, so this one was called Osterkopf by Scepter Brewing Arts, and this is a brewery that's like right around the corner from us. I haven't actually been to this brewery yet, but I figured I'd pick up a can at our local bottle shop, and this is a Southern Oyster Rauch beer.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure Rauch beers are smoked beers, mm-hmm. and this one definitely has like a smoked flavor going on. Yeah, what were your thoughts on this beer?
Yeah, so immediately, like, you can't deny the fact that there's smoke going on in this beer. It's like, it's almost like a combination of scotch, which certainly has smoky elements to it, and a beer. But these types of beers are made with malt that is like dried over smoke, like over an open flame, so it imparts some of that flavor in the malts, and you certainly taste that in this beer. And I don't know if all like oyster beers are also Rauch beers. I don't think so. But
I've had like an oyster stout before.
Yeah,
I loved that.
Yeah, I think like, so traditionally oysters, like, they lent themselves, I think, to the clarifying process of the beers. But now I think like literally there are like oyster flavors that get imparted into the beer. But
it tastes a touch briny, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, well, so the fact that this combines a Rauch beer, which is a smoked beer, with oyster flavors, it totally makes me feel like I'm just like slurping down some oysters that were like roasted over like an open wood fire. It definitely makes me think of my favorite scotch, which is Talisker, which has a super briny note to it, along with a smoke. This is like the beer equivalent to Talisker, if there's any scotch fans out there who like that type of beer. But I really enjoyed it, man. This is not a style we normally drink, but I'm glad that you and I got to share this one today. Yeah, what were your thoughts on it, though, overall?
It's definitely a funky style, and it's definitely one. I think I've literally had one other Rauch beer before in my life, maybe two. And so, yeah, the smoked element of a beer is interesting, because that's not what you're expecting going into it. I think a lot of our listeners who are like craft beer novices, they might not be into this beer.
Might
be a little too out there for them. But
unless you really like barbecue, other
or scotch, you know, scotch. If you like scotch,
sure.
But it's kind of that earthy, smoky brininess to it, and I thought it was like fascinating. It was kind of fun to get to try something that was completely off the beaten path on the show today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks that want show notes for this episode, there's a lot that we're going to link to, and that's up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And Joel, that's going to be it for this episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.